Okay, good morning. We'll get started. Okay. So last time we were talking about issues to do with the radio channel. So we started with the idea of spread spectrum modulation, and this was a way for radio systems to avoid sort of channel effects that would happen at the sort of specific narrow bands in the frequency range. Okay, and the idea was that you would spread your signal over a wider band. And we looked at frequency hopping and direct sequencing. We also looked at how the system could be used to provide multiplexing, so to provide multiple signals within the same frequency spectrum. And we looked at the idea of how to provide the sequencing codes for these modulation techniques. We then went back to some extent and looked at why spread spectrum might be a good idea. More generally, we again looked at the characteristics of radio channels. Okay. Antennas are the devices by which we transmit radio signals, and we saw that they could be either directional, so pointed in a specific direction, directing their power in a specific direction, or radiating uniformly, either in a sphere or at least in a circular plane. Okay, and we noted that there's a concept of a gain factor for directional antennas. So obviously, if you concentrate your power in a specific direction, you're able to send a stronger signal in that direction than if you spread it out over all directions. Okay, then we got to sort of what's going to be most significant for us, particularly now in this next lecture, where we're looking at the sort of the design of cells and the design of cellular systems, and that's the propagation of the radio waves. And the idea here is that the power of the signal decreases with distance, and it decreases with distance by some somewhat unknown factor. Okay. Now there are clear factors. Free space loss is the first of these. And so if you're in space again transmitting a signal with nothing else to disturb it, then the power is still going to decrease as the square of the distance. What we then observed was that the environment introduced a whole range of other factors which would affect how the power decreased. And so these had to do with sort of, again, just the medium through which the signal is traveling, just traveling through air rather than space, how much humidity is in the air is all going to have an impact. If you have a terrain, then signals are going to start bending around objects, bouncing off objects, etc. Okay. And so we looked at a number of ways of modeling these sorts of effects. We looked at sort of a simple two-path model. We also looked at empirical models, so models that sort of gained data through measurements, through observations of specific systems, and then sought to characterize that mathematically. And, well, one conclusion you can come to is that, well, it's a complicated problem. Okay. For this lecture, we're going to sort of sweep all those complications under the carpet and make a quick assumption that power decreases as some factor of distance. Not necessarily distance squared, maybe distance cubed, but some factor of distance. Okay. And so this assumption is sort of the basis for sort of simple analysis of cellular systems. And then, of course, what goes on from then is sort of introducing or trying to reintroduce the complexities of sort of the actual systems versus our simple assumptions. So again, today we're going to look at sort of the basic ideas behind the principles of cellular networks. Okay, and how do you provide primarily for this lecture the coverage? So if the idea is you need radio access over a wide area, how do you cover the whole area with a single system? Okay, so the primary text, again, is William Stallings. The Black Book also has a very nice discussion of sort of this topic. And then William Lee sort of has a lot more, a lot more on sort of how things are done in practice. So some of, he would have discussions of sort of the later part of this lecture and sort of how things, again, deviate from the very, very simple basic assumptions that we make. Okay. So we'll start with looking at sort of the very basic way in which a cellular network is organized. So just to have a picture in our minds of what we're talking about, and then we'll have a look at sort of how a call is handled sort of in this very basic, simple setup. And then we'll look at sort of the mathematical analysis of the setup. So how do we sort of decide distances, areas, power, etc. And once we've done that, again, we'll look at some of the more practical issues with providing this sort of setup. So we'll look at power control. So how does one decide the power levels at which a base station transmits, the power levels at which the mobile telephones or mobile devices transmit? Okay. We'll then, and increasing capacity is also sort of a practical issue. How do you get sort of more out of your system? And sort of in the middle there, we'll have a look at traffic engineering from a fairly theoretical point of view. And so this is just the idea of how do you sort of determine what capacity your system is. Once you've laid out your cells, you know how many channels you have in a given area. But the question then becomes sort of how many users can you accommodate using that number of channels. Okay, so if you took 509 last time, you looked, you realized that you can have more users than you have channels available because not everybody wants to use the system at the same time. Okay, and so we'll have a look at, well, it's the Erlang's theory And he, Erlang developed this for the wired networks, but a lot of the principles apply to cellular systems as well. So we'll have a look at what we can say about cellular systems and, again, note sort of where the complications arise in trying to make this sort of analysis. Okay. So what are the goals of cellular networks? And arguably the primary goal is to get large scale coverage, so large sort of scale access to sort of networking. And so again, if you think about having, for instance, a wireless LAN, that gives you excellent access within a certain radius, and then when you, if you're outside of that radius, you have no access. Okay. And so, in contrast to that, this is an attempt to give you access sort of universally, no matter where you go. Okay. The second aspect is mobility. So the way you're going to get this access is essentially a number of access points. Obviously, you can't rely on a single access point to give you cover, to give you connectivity no matter where you are. You are eventually going to move out of the range. And so, in these sorts of systems, when you're moving out of the range of one access point, you're moving into the range of another. And so how do you maintain your connectivity sort of seamlessly as you're moving from the one access point to another? Okay. And so from the point of view primarily of the mobile users, the mobile devices, you want to do this with as little power consumption as possible. And from the point of view of the network, this is, you're going to have to, you've only got a certain bandwidth, and so you're going to have to find some way of reusing the bandwidth. And the way you're going to do that, of course, is, you know, by this, you know, by using this, you know, the idea of coverage and the idea of distance. So you can reuse a specific frequency as long as the two channels that are using it are sufficiently far apart. Again, this is relying on the propagation effect where, you know, the power that you receive is proportional to the distance, or to the inverse of the distance. Okay, so the basic layout is going to be cellular, and so you are going to have a number of access points. In this case, we call them base stations, and each base station has an area of connectivity. The areas should combine to produce full coverage of, sort of again, a wider area. Okay. Each base station with its, each cell now, the area covered by a base station, is going to make use of a certain number of channels, so a certain number of frequencies with which to do its transmissions. And so what we'll need to do now is figure out how we assign these channels or frequencies so that there's not an over amount of interference. Okay, so as a first cut, you might think of, well, if you've got base stations are next to each other, maybe they should use different channel sets. Again, that works as long as you're not using CDMA. For the most part of this lecture, we're going to assume we have orthogonal channel sets, so you are just sort of your signal is narrow band within a certain range. We will, at sort of appropriate intervals, also discuss sort of how things differ for spread spectrum signals for CDMA systems, because again, they're used. Okay. And naturally, we see that within such a system, we're going to have to, if you're moving, you're going to have to change, you're going to be changing from coverage area to coverage area. Okay, so that's a lot easier to see pictorially than for me to say it. And so what we see here is we have our cells. So you have base stations, and again here we've laid them out nicely at regular intervals, and so their coverage areas are regular. This is the classic hexagonal shape. Again, it's not the only shape possible, but it's sort of the one that most people think of when they think of cellular systems. Okay. Now, for each of these base stations, we assign channel sets. So the numbers in the corner there denote different channel sets. So each of these is using, each with a different number is using a different set, sort of a set of channels. And so to provide connectivity, the base stations are connected to a mobile switching center, which then will connect you into, well, typically the wired network or the phone network or the internet. Okay. And we also see in this example the idea of reuse. You can see that different base stations, which are not adjacent to each other, are using the same channel sets. So, for instance, near the top, you've got 7 on the left-hand side and 7 on the right-hand side. Okay, and they're roughly two cells away from each other. Okay, so this is, again, a very nice, regular picture. This is the sort of picture that we're going to sort of have in the back of our mind for the moment anyway. It doesn't necessarily represent how actual cells are laid out, but the basic ideas are there. So the idea that you have to have full coverage, the idea that you have to share channels, etc. Okay, so again, the first question that we have to answer is how do we share channels? And the goal of this is to make sure that base stations, which are using the same channel sets, are not interfering with each other unduly. You get that by just making sure they're far enough away from each other. And so a lot of that is, at least for our simple case, it's a geometry exercise. It's deciding sort of what distances, how you can calculate distances, and how you can lay out cells based on those distances. Okay. Obviously, the overall range of the cell depends on the power at which the base station is transmitting, and what the assumption that we'll make is just that all the base stations are transmitting at the same power level. Okay. there are issues with how you determine exactly what that power level should be. Again, you want to keep it low so that you're not introducing unnecessary interference. And from the mobile unit's point of view, you want to keep it low to increase battery life, but it still has to be high enough to overcome sort of noise in the system. Okay. We're not going to look at noise specifically. For this lecture, we're going to look instead at interference caused by sort of other signals within the system. But you should be aware that that's a separate issue to the noise issue. So you do need at least some minimum transmission power level in order to have your signal interpreted sort of outside of whether you have interference or not. Okay, so we'll look at, again, trying to decide how many channels do we need? How does that impact our sort of the design of our network? And again, as we said, that's complicated by mobility. And then we'll look at sort of a collection of techniques for taking this basic setup and then adding capacity, so increasing the number of channels you can offer to the users. Okay, so before we jump into the details of the setup and how we arrange this coverage and how we regulate signal interference, we'll just take a quick look at one scenario of how a call is set up, and then again, sort of what are the issues involved. Okay. So, again, our access point for the user is called a base station, and it includes an antenna, so the actual communication point, a controller, which is going to sort of regulate channel usage, and then a number of transceivers for dealing with multiple mobile units or mobile devices within the cell covered by the base station. Okay. Uplink refers to communication from the mobile unit to the base station. Downlink refers from the base station to the mobile unit. Okay. So what the base station provides on the one end is a link, a radio link to the users. The ultimate goal of the users is to achieve network connectivity, and so the base station is also connected to, there's a number of terms, either a mobile switching unit or a mobile telecoms switching office. So a device that handles connectivity from the base station to the public networks, either the internet or the telephony networks. Okay. And so we can look at how we can set up a call within this system. And this is going to be that our example here is a mobile to mobile call. So essentially we're going to have to go from a user to a base station from the base station back to this mobile telecoms office. From there to a second base station, and from the second base station to a second user. Okay, so those would be the links in the chain. So there's a number of steps to providing this connectivity and maintaining this connectivity. The first thing the user has to do is locate their base station, find out which cell they're in. Okay, and so they're going to look for the strongest signal and connect to the base station with the strongest signal. If they want to make a call, they have to ask the base station to handle that connection from them. The base station relays that request to the MTSO. The MTSO then has to try to locate the second user, and so it will do this through a paging process where essentially it asks all its base stations where the user is. When the base station has been found, the base station can then finish the link to the end, to the receiver, like the second user, and complete the connection. So again, we have this chain from first user to first base station to MTSO, from MTSO to second base station to second user. Okay. And so that connection has to be maintained so throughout the call. And again, for the moment, we'll think of having a circuit switch system. So you've established a circuit, essentially. The complexity now is what happens if your users are moving. And so here our second user is moved from one cell to another, so from the control of one base station to another. And so the system also is going to have to arrange to handle that transfer. And as you know, for mobile telephone calls, that transfer is handled seamlessly without the user being aware, hopefully. Okay, so again, in the initialization phase, the base station broadcasts control signals, which essentially give the mobile units an indication of power, and the mobile unit picks the strongest signal. It then connects with the base station and registers with the switching office with information including the user identity and the user's current location. Okay. When the user wants to make a call, they have to request a connection over sort of specific dedicated control channels. Those channels are shared among multiple users, so you have to wait for the channel to become idle. And the base, once you've made that request to the base station forwards it to the MTSO. At the paging stage, the MTSO again asks the base stations how to find the destination mobile unit, the one that we're trying to call. Okay, so at the second mobile, they recognize that the request, the connection request is for them, and they respond to the base station, which then forwards that response to the MTSO. The MTSO sets up the circuit, including choosing the channels, and notifies the base stations, which in turn notify the mobile units. And so that's then a circuit is established, and that's sort of unchanging as long as the mobile units stay within the cell that they originated in. Okay. If they don't stay within the cell, then handover has to occur. Yeah. Handover is sort of one of the more complicated parts of this procedure. And there's a number of ways. The main thing is, how do you make the decision as to when to switch from one base station to another? Okay. And so this decision can be made by the base stations themselves based on sort of what they know about the connection, or there can be explicit feedback from the mobile units. Okay. And so what sorts of things might be sort of required to make that decision? Now, the obvious one is signal strength. So, again, from the mobile unit's perspective, they want to have a strong connection. Okay, from the system point of view, well, obviously that's still important, but sort of overall system considerations might enter into the decision as well. So, if a particular cell is congested, then the system might try to delay moving additional users into that cell, so keep them with their base station longer. And similarly, if the user is in a congested cell, moving out of it, they might try to sort of move them out a little faster. Okay. Even the idea of signal strength and using signal strength to decide the issue still has a few complications. The sort of simplest policy you could think of would be to take the strongest signal. But imagine what would happen if you're traveling along the edge of two cells. If you're on the edge of two cells, then there's very little difference between the two signals. At one point, one might be stronger. The next moment, the next might be stronger. The next moment, the first is stronger again. So you can get this bouncing back and forth. Now, handover is not instantaneous. It actually takes time, and so it's sort of problematic if the decision, or sort of if the criterion along which you're making your decision is changing too rapidly. Okay, and so there are a number of sort of additions to that basic policy that try to take that into account. You have strongest signal plus threshold, which says only change if the signal drops below a threshold, so it's genuinely weak, and the other signal is stronger. So the assumption is that this would be a way of ensuring that the other signal was sort of significantly stronger. It doesn't require it, but it assumes it. Okay. Strongest signal with hysteresis requires that you change if the new signal is stronger by a fixed amount. And so again, this is trying to ensure the idea that you're not just traveling along a boundary, but you're genuinely entering into the cell of another base station. You can combine threshold and hysteresis, so stick with your signal as long as it's okay, and if not, make sure the other signal is significantly better before you move. Okay. And finally, you can have sort of, you can try and come up with cleverer techniques, which try to decide, again, in terms of directionality, are you heading towards a stronger signal or not? Okay, so is the signal steadily getting stronger, in which case it might be a good idea to change, or not, in which case, again, you might be in one of these boundary conditions and it's not worth your while to change. Okay. So anyway, that's sort of the basic idea of a call setup and sort of the bare bones functionality of a mobile telephony system. Now we're going to return to the looking at how we lay out these cells. How do we decide where to put the base stations? How do we decide how many base stations we need, how we can cover an area, etc. Okay. Now, this is, again, a very simple model. We're going to be assuming that our base stations are laid out in a regular pattern. We're going to be assuming that our base stations are transmitting sort of at the same power level. We're going to be assuming that the attenuation, the decrease in power level, is uniform. Okay. And so again, the idea is that if you have base stations and you put them far enough away from each other, then they can use the same carrier frequencies, the same channels, without interfering unduly with each other. Okay. And so you see here, you've got two base stations. They're using the same channel, but obviously the signal from the if you think of the signal on the left as being your desired signal and the one on the right as being your interference, then for at least some range, the signal is significantly stronger than the interference. Okay, and so you should be able to recover your signal. Okay, just as terminology, the interference from other cells using the same set of frequencies is called co-channel interference. And the whole principle upon which cellular systems work is that as long as we keep base stations using the same frequency far enough apart from each other, then we can reuse these frequencies. Because again, you only have a fixed number of them within your bandwidth, so you have to reuse them. So I've already discussed this or mentioned this in passing. There's two basic ways you can set up your channels within the cell, and again, you can do you can set up orthogonal channels where the frequency spectrum is broken up into individual unshared frequencies. Okay. The other option is that you can use CDMA techniques where you have a spread spectrum signal But you're keeping individual users from using the same, hopefully, from using the same spectrum at the same time. Okay. Most of the time we're going to be talking about orthogonal systems, so where we've split up our frequency domain into unshared portions. Again, I'll mention how the same concepts work for CDMA as well. Okay. What we need to do is, again, to keep our signal to interference ratio as high as possible. So again, you need to limit the level of interference that a signal is going to experience. And you do that by, well, again, keeping the base stations far apart from each other. Okay, that's a bit rough, because obviously the range of the base stations is going to play into that calculation as well, and we'll see how that happens. Okay. So, for orthogonal systems, we're going to define a minimum reuse distance, and based on that distance, well, and again, the distance, the ratio of that distance to the cell size, it's a geometrical exercise to determine how many cells you need. With CDMA, again, it's a bit more complex since all the cells are using the same frequencies, and the only way to control interference is by clever choice of your spreading codes. Okay, so we have this idea of coverage via base stations, and so we've got these nice regular layouts. In this case, they're hexagonal. They don't have to be, although it's considered to be a nice shape for these systems. And we now have to share out our channels. So we group the cells into clusters, where clusters share the entire spectrum. And then individual channel reuse happens from cluster cluster. Depending on how many cells are in a cluster, you get your channel reuse occurring sort of at smaller or greater distances. Okay, so just to start with, actually, obviously, our base stations are radiating in a circular pattern. So the idea of having these sharp linear divisions between base stations isn't quite accurate. You've got these sort of regions of overlap. Again, the hexagonal shape is considered to be essentially a quite good approximation to circular, and one that sort of has nice geometrical properties, so you can lay them out again very regularly. If you squint hard enough, if you think of this as your cluster, you can think of this cluster again as being roughly hexagonal shaped. Another popular shape is square or diamond shape. And again, it's nice and regular, and you can sort of take clusters, and the clusters are also diamond shape. And it's argued that this is a good approximation to what happens in urban areas where you might lay your antennas out, well, U.S. urban areas maybe, where you might lay your antennas out along the street system, which would be grid-like. Okay. Now, what this gives us, again, is a rough shape. The actual physical size of the cell is going to be determined by your power of transmission. And again, you've got to transmit at a high enough power to overcome noise as well as interference. Well, you're not going to overcome interference, but to overcome noise. And so, essentially, the higher power you transmit at, if you want to keep the same interference level, sort of the larger you have to make your cells. Okay. Again, just as a reality check, these nice regular shapes are, again, assuming that we've set up our system somewhere in space, not along the surface of the Earth or in the middle of a city. And typically there are additional constraints placed on the system in terms of where we can put our base stations. You can't necessarily lay them out sort of at a uniform distance. And as we saw last time, the terrain is also going to impact on the effectiveness of the base station. So the power level at which any individual base station can transmit, or the power level at which their signal will be received. So they're going to run into all these effects of, you know, multipath, etc. Okay. So what we're going to do next is a nice exercise, and it really does illustrate sort of the basic points of the cellular layout, but typically it's nowhere near sufficient to actually determine where you're going to put specific base stations. The mobile telephone companies would have very complex simulation packages to try and help them make planning decisions about where to put base stations. Okay. So, we've said that we have a fixed number of frequencies that we can use, so a fixed number of channels. And we have to share out those channels amongst all of our cells. And so what we do is we group the cells into clusters, and then the clusters can use the full range of the channels. So typically they would split them evenly amongst the cells in the clusters. Okay. And so then you repeat the clustering pattern over and over again, and that gives you your channel allocation over all of the cells. The characteristics of the clusters, how many cells there are in the cluster, affects, obviously, how many channels per cell, and it will also affect the distance between individual cells using a specific channel set. Okay, and so we can see that for this cluster 3, we have a certain distance. If the cluster was 7, well, you'd have a different distance, obviously. Okay. The distance between two cells using the same channel set is called the reuse distance, D. And our signal to interference ratio is going to be a function of the size of the cell itself and then how far the cell is away from other cells using the same channel. So it's a function of the radius of the cell and the reuse distance. Okay. Now, calculating this signal to interference ratio using those two factors, it's essentially just a geometric exercise. You need to decide how this distance D is a factor of sort of the number of cells traveled through. Okay, so this is, we'll bounce back and forth between diamonds and hexagons. Geometrically, diamonds are easy. We say the radius of a cell for a diamond is the perpendicular distance from the center to one of the edges. And what we can see is that the reuse distance D is going to be a function of R and how many cells you travel through. Okay. And so in this example, essentially our clusters are going to be four cells, and so that gives us the distance between any two cells using the same channel set. And, you know, again, you can just count it up in terms of the number of cells that we have to travel through to get from one cluster to the next. From one cell to the next one using the same set. Okay. So your reuse distance is then R, so to get to the edge of the first cell, 2R to get through the intervening cell, and another R to get to the final cell. Okay. So this is, again, sort of interesting because our reuse distance now is a function of our cell size as well. Okay, so finding the reuse distance for hexagonal cells is essentially a slightly fiddly geometry exercise. Again, what we'd like to do is somehow relate it to traversing a number, a uniform number of cells. And so what we do is that we change our coordinate system so that we're traveling at any point we want to travel sort of perpendicularly from the center of a cell to one of its edges. And so there are essentially two directions in order to do that. There's two directions you need to go, sort of up and down, or again off at an angle. Okay, so we call the U direction the up-down direction and the V direction the angle, and we then have a coordinate system by which we can, again, traverse through a number of cells, again, going from center to center to center of the cells. Obviously, after that, what you have to do, you have to translate back to the actual distance, but we can we can calculate the actual distance in terms of the number of cells we've gone center to center to center through. Okay. So, as an example, G, you move 1 in the B direction, 0 in the U direction. S, you're moving 1 in the U direction, 1 in the B direction. H, you'd be moving 2 in the U direction, 0 in the B direction, etc. Okay. So it's easy to calculate the distances along either the V or the U direction. Again, for each cell you traverse from center to center, you're just going 2D. Okay. And similarly, then it doesn't matter whether you're going in the U or the V direction, you're still going a distance of 2D. Okay. And we can calculate D as a factor of our cell radius, R, as well. So we get D is square root of 3 over 2R. So if we're trying to determine now the distance from the center of one cell to another cell, then we've essentially gotten two sides of a triangle. We've got our U direction, our V direction, and our actual distance that we want to calculate completes that triangle. So again, it's a geometric exercise to just calculate what that last side of the triangle is. Okay. And so we, for this triangle, we know the length of the two sides. We also know the angles involved. Okay, so we know this is 30 degrees. This is then, or this whole thing is 60 degrees, that's 30 degrees. So we can work out from that what our distance is. Essentially what we need to do, well, one way of looking at it is we could try and change this sort of irregular triangle into a right triangle. We can figure out what the distance is along the two edges of the right triangle, and then just use a Pythagoras to figure out the final the distance D. Okay. And what we find when we do that is that our reuse distance is indeed some function of, again, the size of the cell, so the cell radius R, and the number of cells we've traversed in each direction. So I is the number of cells we traverse in the U direction, J is the number of cells we traverse in the V direction. Okay. So again, it's a geometry exercise. Okay. Now, we have a number of factors to play with. We have our cell size, R. We have our reuse distance, D. And if we fix D and R, then we will also then fix the number of intervening cells and hence the cell cluster size. Okay. And so for any given cluster size N, we know that that is in turn going to regulate how many channels there are per cluster, per cell. Okay, so the cluster overall can use a certain, the full range of channels. Those have to be divided over N cells within the cluster. Okay. For this reason, the size of the cluster is referred to as the reuse factor. Okay, so just to give a few examples of clusters and reuse factors, we have here's clusters of 7, clusters of 4, and clusters of 3. Okay, and again, for each of those, the distance relative to the reuse distance relative to the cell radius is different. If we go back to our equation, the difference is going to enter into in this j squared plus I squared plus I plus 1 term. Essentially, the bigger that term is, the smaller r is relative to d, and the greater the number of clusters, the number of cells in the cluster is. Okay. So, looking at it for the diamond-shaped cells, again, we know that our reuse distance is twice the number of cells traversed times the radius of the cell. And so then our reuse factor is given in terms of how many cells there are then in this cluster, and so we have k, our size is k, or our geometry gives us a k by k cell layout, and so again we can there's a relationship between the number of cells in the cluster, the reuse distance, and the cell size. Okay. And so, for our example here, our reuse distance gives us a k of 4. The k of 4 gives us an n of 16. And again, you can sort of cycle around between these three three factors: the number of cells that you need in a cluster, the size of the cells, and the distance you need between individual cells using the same channels. Okay, you can cycle around in the same way for hexagonal cells, and so roughly we say that the area of a that clusters for hexagonal cells are roughly hexagonal in shape with a cell radius of a perpendicular distance to the edge of d over 2, which gives us a cell radius of d over 2 divided by cosine 30 degrees. And so that'll give you an area for your cell cluster. And then you know what the area of a cell is, so you can calculate that again geometrically. And so the number of cells you need to cover that area is going to be given by the size of the cluster divided by the size of the cell. And so we get the number of cells is related again to the distance, the reuse distance, and the cell radius. But we can also relate that again to our I and J terms. Okay. And what this does is that it limits the possible ends to integer values of I and J. Okay. Okay. There's a number of ways of making the channel assignments. This is a bit of a complicated way. Essentially, when you have the clusters, you just assign them, and then you tessellate the clusters, so you just lay out the clusters uniformly, and that gives you your channel assignment. Okay. So, has anybody noticed what we sort of haven't mentioned so far in this discussion? We've essentially said nothing about power and nothing about interference. We really have been doing a geometrical exercise about how you can fit whatever shape cell you have into layouts. Okay. The whole purpose of fitting these cells into the layouts is to keep the interference down to a certain level. So the next thing we have to examine is how do we sort of deal with interference? Okay. The interference is going to be a function not only of how far you are away from, if one cell is away from another cell, but also the size then of the cells, okay? And the size of the cell is related to the power level at which the base station is transmitting, okay? So we call the ratio of D to R the co-channel interference reducing factor, and just intuitively, again, the more cells you have intervening, the sort of farther away the cells are, sort of relative to the size of the cell, is going to give you a better signal-to-interference ratio. Okay, and so we'll jump back to diamond-shaped cells just because they're easier to draw. And we can see that we can sort of have the same shape, the same layout, and just sort of expand it, make it bigger, and we'll have the same co-channel interference factor. And so essentially these two, the smaller and then this larger layout, are going to give you the same interference ratio. Okay. Now, the other thing you can do is, again, increase the number of intervening cells between any two using the same channel set. That is going to increase your co-channel interference ratio, and it's going to improve your signal-to-interference ratio. What we can see here is the cost, then, of doing that is that we're having to split up our channel set more finely. So, say we had 16 channels. In this system, each cell will get 4 channels. In this system, each cell only gets 1 channel. Okay, so you're having to sort of segment up your spectrum more sort of in terms of sort of area. So in any given location, you're going to have less channels available to you. Okay. So, finally, we get to our signal to interference ratio. Now that we've sort of set our things up as clusters and we've calculated, well, both the distance from one cell to another, and we've sort of compared it to the actual radius of the cell. Okay. Now, any cell using the same channel set is going to produce interference for the cell we're examining. Okay, so in this case, the cell in the center. Okay. We're assuming that, again, our power is dropping as some factor of distance. And so each interference is going to be of the power of the interfering signal is going to be a function of the distance of that cell from our initial cell. And for power within our cell, so power of the received signal, we'll say that it's at its minimum when you're at the edge of the cell. Okay, so you get it drops from some P at the center to P over R to the gamma at the edge of the cell. Okay. So our signal to interference ratio is a function of distances. Remember that we've assumed that all of the stations are transmitting at the same power, so our power terms have dropped out of this equation. So as long as they're all transmitting at the same power, that's not a factor. Okay. So you have your signal, which is at its weakest at the edge of the cell. Then you have a number of interfering signals, and they're at various distances from your original cell, and so each one will contribute a slightly different factor. Typically, what we do is we assume that the only ones contributing a significant amount, remember these things are decreasing as some power, you know, greater than 2, the only ones that are contributing a significant amount are the closest interfering cells. Okay. So we assume that we're only dealing with the nearby cells, and so in that case, if we have hexagons, we are dealing with 6 cells close by to our the cell we're trying to figure out the SIR for. Okay, and again, we see that that becomes then a function that all these cells are equidistant from our cell, so we can move that the sum becomes just k times a fixed distance to the minus gamma, and we collect up terms, and we get again that we're a function of d over r, which is again our value q. Okay. So that's the co-channel interference reducing factor. Okay. And as we said intuitively earlier, the bigger the Q, the higher your signal to your interference. Okay, and as we've observed before, the number of cells required is also a function of distance and radius. So if we have a desired signal to interference ratio, that's going to lead us to having a desired Q, and Q is in turn going to be dependent on the number of cells in our cluster. Okay. So, yeah, again, the whole thing just hinges on geometry. Okay. So, as we've also observed before, the number of cells in our cluster gives us the number of channels within each cell. Okay. So ultimately, your desired signal to interference ratio impacts on the number of cells you need in a cluster, and that impacts, again, on the channels that you can provide in any given location. Okay, so just as an example here, we need N to give us a certain signal to interference ratio, and so we get an N of 20. Well, we have to, again, limit that to some actual geometrical pattern. So the nearest N, which is producible given I and given an integer I and j, is 21. And so we can also calculate the total number of channels we have. And so those channels have to be split up between our cells, and that gives the number of channels we can provide per cell. Okay, so let me just finish this off and we'll take a break. For CDMA systems, it's slightly different. in the sense that we are again using all of our channels essentially for all of the communications. Okay, so we're using the full frequency spectrum for each connection. Again, we assume that we have some sort of spreading code that's going to sort of keep the signals distinct. But that distinction has now two components. There's a measure of how distinct it is within the cell. So two connections within the same cell can interfere with each other, again, if your spreading codes aren't orthogonal. And then connections outside of the cell can also interfere with each other. And again, the power is going to be a function of the distance from the connection. And so you get an internal component of interference and an external component of interference. The amount that two signals interfere by is a function of the parameters of the spreading code and the cleverness of your processing algorithm by which you decode your signal. Okay. And so I don't want to really dwell on this a lot. We can make some simplifying assumptions. We can assume that within the cell there's power control going on, which means that the power levels for the received signal and the interference signals are equal, so they can be sort of lumped into one power term. And we also just lump our external interference into a single term. And doing that, we can simplify our equation, and we now have something it's a function of sort of the overall number of users in the system. And again, that function is related to your desired signal to interference ratio. So obviously, the more users you have in the system, the lower your signal to interference ratio is going to be, and vice versa. Okay, so we'll take a break there, and we'll pick up, we'll say a few words about power control. So again, to date, we've been just saying, well, everybody, or the base station anyway, transmits at a fixed power level. That's not necessarily true. And in real systems, we'll then look at traffic engineering. So what we've looked at now is how many channels we can provide per cell, so in any given location. But how does providing channels relate to actually serving customers? How many customers can you allow into your system? And then we'll look at some practical implementations that sort of increase capacity from this point. Okay, so let's take about a 15-minute break and be back here at 1:45.